Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Hello friends and welcome to episode number 7 of the Fergan podcast. I'm here with a special guest and a good friend, Phil from Mimmers Brunner. Mimmers Brunner was a YouTube channel which was quite popular over the last few years, producing some excellent videos on the history and the morality and the worldview and the pagan ways of our Northern European ancestors. So I'm really pleased to have Phil here. Phil's a good friend of mine, and we've blotted together many times. We've spent lots of time together in real life. We've had some wonderful in-depth discussions about various topics, and I've been really looking forward to getting Phil on for an episode of the podcast. So Phil, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Mike. How about yourself?
Great. Yeah, good. Yeah, it's good to speak to you as always, mate. And I'm sure we'll have a really good conversation here. So Mimmers Brunner has kind of been on hold for a while now. How long has it been since the last video?
I think it's been nearly a year. And the time between the last video, I think there was quite a while in between making that and the one before it. So we've been very quiet lately, sadly.
Yeah, Mimmers Brunner has like a kind of like a sister channel called Mimmers Council, and during the spring of 2020 I was working quite closely with Phil and the editor of Mimmers Brunner and Mimmers Council on some videos exposing the fraud of COVID-19, as it was named at the time. We had some good live discussions then on the Mimmers Council channel. Obviously that was a bit of a departure at the time from the more pagan focus of Mimmers Brunner, so we did have a kind of a spate of activity at that point, didn't we?
Yeah, there was a little bit, yeah, because the world changed a little bit on us quite fast as well. So, I mean, we did the documentary that we worked on together, and that was to try and just get some information out there early. But yeah, so we've wanted to go back. My main focus has always been Mimmers Brunner, Mimmers Council was kind of a side channel to deal with some of the more political aspects, or I suppose you could say conspiratorial, some people would call it, including events such as COVID and other things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really Mimmers Brunner that's captured people's imagination. And some of those videos you produced, such as the Consequence of Cowardice and various others, that, I mean, they did the rounds quite a lot when you released them. They were extremely well received and incredibly well produced videos. You know, they were well edited, well narrated. They had an extremely important message, and they really captured a lot of people's imagination. So hopefully you're going to tell us that there's more of that to come.
Yeah, I mean, for those that don't know anything about Mimmers Brunner, obviously it's not just me. I write and narrate, but obviously we have a Rhys, and he's the editing magician behind the works. Without him, the videos just wouldn't look, or they wouldn't have been well received. Well, they wouldn't have gone around, like you say, anywhere near as much, because he makes them watchable, but more than watchable. It makes them actually quite brilliant. I'm even impressed by them, what he does with my words and things. And obviously, there's a third member, and that is Hallinder, who does all the music. Early on, we took some of his songs, and we were speaking to him, and then he started to write songs specifically for us. So we got pretty reasonable production value on some of those pieces, but I can't take credit for any of that. I just writ it and spoke it.
Yeah, Reese is a really great guy, very switched on, very very knowledgeable guy, and so is Hallinder. And in the time that you've been doing Mimir's Brunner, I've actually known Phil for since even before he began the Mimir's Brunner project, I believe. And during the whole time of Mimir's Brunner, Phil has spoken very very highly of both Reese and Hallinder for their talents, and all three of them come together to create, you know, some really wonderful videos. So anyone who's not familiar with Mimir's Brunner, and you'd be forgiven for not being familiar because they, you know, because they've been a bit inactive for the last year or more, but I gather that they will be back with more videos soon. And regardless, the videos that they have produced over the last few years are timeless, and you know, they're worth going back to. And I've personally rewatched them several times myself, some of them. So it's a great kind of collaborative effort, that, and really brilliantly presented. And I've also had a bit of involvement myself, helping to design the logo for Mimir's Brunner, and some of the merchandise as well, didn't I?
You did the t-shirt design, the Kimby one.
Yeah. I was pleased.
Oh, you did all of
that
t-shirts, really, to be honest, because the other ones were the logo. So,
yeah,
you've pretty much been our main designer, and everything that we've needed for professional designer for design.
Yeah, it's been an honour. So, what have you got lined up then with Mimir's Brunner? What sort of, can you share any of the ideas that you have lined up, or give us any hints as to what might be coming in the future?
Well, as you say, we have been very inactive. So, and it's something that's partly a bit of drain with everything that's going on. It's hard to get in, partly because of life getting in the way and things that you have to do in the real world. But we have been planning and plotting since we haven't stopped, really. It's just getting the time to fully do a project. And after a break, we decided that, because after it had gone so long, we wanted to come back with something quite big. So we have been working away slowly at the moment on quite a big project next. And maybe change the direction of Mimir's Brunner slightly, in the sense that it is still keeping the same fundamentals that it has at the moment, which we can talk about in a bit, but maybe longer form videos, because although our videos... we put a lot of effort into them. Some of them are only they're very short. And I think people always wanted more. So we're going to try and do some longer videos, even up to 45 minutes, an hour videos. But they're going to take a little bit more effort. So what we've got planned next is essentially the saga of Starkad, or Starkada, or Starkatha. It depends how you want to pronounce his name. No one's really definitive on that. And what that is a project where he's a very interesting and a favorite figure of history of mine, with Norse mythology. He crosses the boundary of mythology, historic figure. And what I've basically done is read through every saga that mentions him or his ancestry, and tried to compile it together into his own saga, because he doesn't have one. So it's probably, we're aiming at the moment for about 45 minutes to an hour with it. And that's going to be animated in a very unique way. Not full animation, but in a kind of eerie way. We've got a few things planned. But that's our project at the moment. We're working on basically the first part at the moment. We're trying to get that right. And once that's right, it'll give us a template to move forward. So we hope to
set the tone for it, yeah.
Yeah. And we need to learn. It's a very different format for us to. It's kind of like making a mini play, but it's not a play. It's got a narrator, but it's got scenes almost. So it's a very different way. But it's something that sparked our interest in making videos again as we're learning new things. And that's something that I think is important in life in general, is not just keep doing the same thing over and over again to try and test yourself and see what you can do and, you know, get the old brain ticking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I've no doubt that it's going to be, you know, Phil is someone who doesn't rush projects, and there's, you know, that shows in the final result, because they, you know, they are quality. And actually, you know, what we're talking about here with Phil's interest in kind of shining a light on these slightly more obscure aspects of Northern European mythology and history, I think that kind of leads onto the conversation that we'd like to have this evening, which we planned out, which is that it's, you know, it's very easy these days, particularly at this current time, to become embroiled in these kind of these global news stories and dramas and the politics of the time. But Phil is someone who I've always admired his ability to kind of stay out of the drama of the kind of the folkish scene, so to speak. And why is that, Phil? Why is it that you have been so mindful to stay out of that and to rather focus your efforts on, you know, bringing to light the morality and the worldview and the, you know, the just to you know, shine a spotlight on the glory of our Northern European ancestors rather than to dwell on the, you know, current affairs?
Well, I think every generation has its challenges. You know, as I've said to you many times in the conversations, you know, slavery is slavery, death is death, and every generation has faced it. The struggle of life is eternal. And you can look at that. I mean, our last video spoke about this. So, you know, and that video came from me talking to my children, trying to explain to them that in our back garden, a million battles were taking place of life and death, not so much heroic actions, but in a sense they are, you know, plants, from plants to animals to bugs to microbes. There's literally war everywhere, right? There's this this fight for survival. So when I look at the modern times, I don't just see it as, you know, like something that needs to always be addressed. And as you said earlier, we try to make our videos timeless. So if you watch it in when it was released, say we release a video tomorrow and you watch it tomorrow, it has just as much relevance in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And I think that's important, because although it's important to get new cover, there's so many people covering current events. There's so many people doing it, and they're doing such a good job. Why really get involved? And as for the drama, I think sometimes we're up against so much. I think sometimes the drama in certain scenes, and this is true for all scenes. It doesn't matter if it's heathen. It doesn't matter if it's political. It doesn't matter if it's conspiratorial. It doesn't matter what you're interested in. If you look, I'm sure if you went and found somebody that was interested in, you know, video games from the 1980s, you'd probably find that there's these dramas involved. It's just part of what we are as human beings. We like it. Yeah. We like to add drama to our life. But with all that's going on at the moment, I think sometimes the small petty dramas and fights that occur within movements, I think, detract and put off new people wanting to find these things out, you know, because, you know, they're forced to choose between two creators they might like because they suddenly fell out, or, you know, we're tribal by nature. That is a good thing, in my opinion, but it can lead to some very silly things when it becomes petty.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with that, but I do think that there is a distinction to be made between petty drama and kind of meaningful discourse. You know, like, yes, for example, there, you know, at the moment with what's going on with this kind of technocratic global takeover, which we're not going to go into tonight, Phil and I, but there are broadly two camps on that issue. And what I try to do personally is, without naming names, without naming my opponents, those who hold a different view, I still like to you know, explain why I think that my position is correct and their position is wrong. But I think people need to realize that that can be done in a non-petty way. Even if you don't particularly like the person that you hold an opposing view to, which is certainly the case with myself, there are those who I don't actually like, and I don't actually value their input very much. But you know, there are ways to go about that without making a petty drama of it. But I think, yeah, you know, Phil does a better job of staying out of that than I do anyway.
No, I would be all for intelligent debate. Sadly, debates on YouTube for a period there, going a while back now, but and I think it still is where they happen. They became quite a thing on YouTube, but they became like they were promoted like fight nights. Do you get me? It wasn't like, let's have a conversation and try to learn from each other, or try and put our ideas forward. It was more like, it's more about just winning the, you know, looking better, not even winning the philosophical argument, about looking better than the other person, you know? And I think that was a bit, but from my perspective is, if I see something that I don't like, that I believe is getting, then I'll make a video and I'll speak without even mentioning the opposite opinion, or there could be varying opinions. I'll make a video just saying what I believe, in a way that I do it, you know. So it'll be, you know, our videos are generally emotionally charged, which is something, I'm an emotional person and I have no problem with that. I embrace that part of me. So I put my perspective over it in my way, and that's all you can ever do. And that's, you know, if people agree with me, that they will or they won't. It's not up to, you know, I'm not here to force people into my opinion.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that issue of emotion a minute, because I think this is something that, you know, Phil and I have kind of bonded over in terms of our perspective on life over the time that we've known each other. You know, I think Phil admires the music that I make with my project Walken. You know, and in turn, I admire the scripts and the narrations that he does with Mimis Brunner. And those two projects share a common kind of theme of expressing, almost expressing ideas through emotion rather than through intellect and through kind of these academic ideas. You know, if you go, you know, anyone who's listening to this who hasn't seen a Mimis Brunner video, if you go back and watch particularly some of their most popular videos, you will be moved. You know, I can guarantee you will be moved by them. And I know from speaking to Phil that when he writes the dialogue for the videos, and when he records it, his aim is to inject as much emotion and as much drama and as much feeling into it as possible, because it's by being moved through those videos. And I try to do the same with my music. I think that creating something that's timeless in a kind of you know, socio-political sense, something that where the lyrics are as relevant 10 years from now as they are today, if you're not expressing very specific ideas of the current time, then what you need to be doing is getting across a very timeless kind of code of ethics or code of conduct across via the medium of emotion. I'm not wrong in saying that that's been your kind of motivation, has it, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, the point, well, when I first, there's a lot of academic speakers and they're very good in our spheres, especially on heathenism. And they will break down some really complex things and bring them to you in a very easy light. You know, these people have gone to universities, they've studied and they're very good at it. But the problem with that to a point becomes that we start to look at the history of man sometimes as more a series of events, an unemotional, whereas we know in our daily lives, you know, the death of a loved one or something, there's so much emotion in there that when we go, oh, this person fought here, then they died, we lose a big aspect of the story, you know, if you look at
speaking about things in the past tense, I think is one of the mistakes that many of us tend to make. You know, we tend to say things like, our ancestors were brave, our folk were brave, our folk were glorious, yeah. You know, our gods were this, our gods were that. Whereas what we really, the way we need to be framing it is, we are this, we are mm-hmm. that. And the reason that we know we are this is because our ancestors were also this.
Yeah, of course. We are them in a very literal sense, you know, mm-hmm. However you want to break it down. And their stories are our stories. And our ancestors saw this the same. You know, they took stories of their specific ancestors or their specific were, you know, that's why we have songs. That's why we have sagas. People wanted to glorify the names of their great. Right. So by being emotionally charged, and also, like I say, I'm just an emotional person. Sometimes when I write certain pieces, it's a challenge to understand a certain aspect of our history. And to for me personally, probably not a very academic way to go about it, but for me personally, I try to use as much all the empathy that I have to try and put myself in them shoes quite literally. And it can be quite an emotional experience when I write certain pieces about certain things that really touch me on an emotional level. And if I feel that, I take the same stance that you said. If I feel this about my ancestors, then maybe they felt something similar too. And to put and add that in, if you know what I mean. And I understand why the academics don't do that, because obviously someone could go, well, I don't think they would feel like that. But that's not really my interest in. My interest is in expressing how I feel about it. And if I'm a reasonable representation of them, then they should have felt something similar at least. So.
Yeah, there's this this kind of popular trope in the dissident right scene, which is, you know, facts don't care about your feelings. You know, I think this is, I mean, this comes more from the kind of the alt-light kind of, you know, light conservative side of things. But a lot of people in our very broad sphere do embrace this idea that, you know, what matters most are facts, and people's emotions are irrelevant to the facts. But I think people like Phil and I, but perhaps kind of set ourselves aside from that a little bit, because, you know, I've never been moved to fight for my folk and for the future of my folk and for the well-being of my folk. I've never been moved to do that by studying, you know, IQ charts for over the last 100 years to see the change in IQ numbers. I've never been moved to do that by, you know, studying the kind of more scholarly framing of, you know, even things which are quite interesting, like linguistics and, you know, how old English morphed into modern English and the etymological, you know, these are things I find interesting, but then that's not what has ever moved me. Whereas, you know, hearing stories about kings who we may be descended from or related to, and about how they literally, you know, I mean, what is it? The case of, is it Red Bad? You did a video, or is it the Kimri and what they, how, yeah, how they, I mean, a lot of Mimir's Brunner's videos are about the Kimri and how they stood in the face of a Roman onslaught, and how they must have felt at the time, and what sacrifices and what, you know, displays of courage were shown at that time. Those are the things that move me. And when I write my music, I try to write it in such a way that it creates an emotional response in the listener. And for me, that's by far the more powerful way to help someone to connect with their culture.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I enjoy reading historic works. I mean, it's pretty much all I read. And I will read the academic papers, but they're there for people to read anyway. If I just made videos stating an academic paper, I wouldn't be adding much to it. I wouldn't be adding part of me, my story as well, and who I am and what I want to convey. But yeah, you're right. In my opinion, history is ruled by emotion. The great leaders, even in the sagas, I mean, look at the great stories that we have of great speeches before battles, they're all emotionally charged. They're talking to people that are probably going to their deaths, right, in a great war of some sort. You know, and it doesn't matter that we have these stories of great speeches going back. I mean, Tacitus wrote about Galgacus, right? Now, obviously, Tacitus wrote the speech. Tacitus was not there. And Agricola, his stepfather, who it's in that book, Agricola, he probably wouldn't have heard it either. So it's very unlikely that the words that Tacitus writes are Galgacus's exactly. He was just trying to capture the essence of what he believed and what they knew of the Caledonians. But what I'm saying is, even there, he talks of a great speech. There's a great English leader that saved his life from the Romans. Well, he would have been a British count, but I forgot his name now. I can't believe I forgot it. But he saved his life by doing an amazing emotional speech to the Romans. And they were so impressed by his ability, his oratory skills, that they let him live. So this idea, that's what's moved people to change the faith, to change the destiny of a whole people. It's not facts. It's emotion. It's somebody being able to use those facts to talk in a way. I mean, if you look at Woden, or Woden, or Woten, or Odin, or Ulfin, however you want to say his name, he's known for his oratory skills, a great poet. And if you look at many of the leaders and gods and goddesses of the ancient North, you'll find many of the warrior types always have this poetic nature to them.
And the
ability
very,
with words.
Yeah, and the very emotion. The very root of Warden's name, Ward or Odd,
yeah,
or Odd. I mean, it means to stir into a frenzy, doesn't it? It's
possessed.
Yeah. So it's, you know, even in his name, we have this very kind of like there's almost this very kind of this tool of creating emotion and of focusing on emotion. I mean, this is where I think film actually becomes quite powerful, you know, even big Hollywood films, you know, I mean, I still to this day, despite the kind of historical inaccuracies of it, one of the films that moves me most is Braveheart. Just because of how beautifully it's performed, and particularly the score. If you ever listen to the score on its own, just the music can almost move you to tears, and coupled with the story that it portrays, as well as the performances and the, you know, a certain amount of authenticity that there is to it, makes for a very moving experience. And I can see how there was this kind of uprise in Scottish nationalism at the time that film came out. You know, I have a copy of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, and I can read about the history of my ancestors in that, but it's very, very dry. A number of years ago, I think it must have been about 15 years ago or something, a straight to TV dramatization of 1066 came out. I think it was called, its full title is 1066, The Battle for Middle Earth. And I distinctly remember watching it on television, on Channel 4, on the night that it aired, because I was really, you know, I'd become interested in Anglo-Saxon history at that time and my heritage, and I'd seen this advertised and I was really excited to see it. And I'm not ashamed to admit that by the end of it, I was in tears, because it brought to life what some of my ancestors, what some of our ancestors would have gone through, the enormous sacrifice and effort that they made to defend their folk. The hopelessness that they were up against, yet despite that hopelessness, they still pushed on, and they pushed themselves to the very, very limit of what they were capable of to defend their land. And I would say, compared to Braveheart, it's not even as well produced a film, but it still brings forth that emotion. And you know, even amateur works like what Mimis Brunner does, which kind of bridges that gap almost between dramatization and a historical telling. It's almost like a poetical version of a historical telling.
Yeah.
That also has a power to move in the same way. And I think music does too. And these are things which Phil and I have spoken about many times, that these are the things that we should be pushing. This is what we should be building for our folk, because helping someone to find the emotion in the wider struggle that we share with our ancestors is the most powerful way to cause someone to make positive changes in their life, to face up to the struggle that, you know, as I say, we share with our ancestors.
Yeah, like you said, the movies breathe life. They breathe the emotion. They don't have to be 100% accurate. I mean, with Mimbersbunny, we do try to be accurate. All I do is I take the words, the historical documents, and I try to breathe the emotion back into them. I try to take them away from being essentially reports. And as you'll know from reading historic works, whether it's Anglo-Saxon Chronicles or earlier stuff, a lot of things are very dry. I mean, a lot of the sagas, well, they're not quite dry. They just have a very strange way of, it takes a while to figure out how they're speaking. So for the layman, or certain translations are not very good because they translate very academically, if you know what I mean. And then some translations, older translations, I find are generally better. They're more fun. They kind of breathe a little bit of the emotion back in.
Yeah, because they're not quite so worried about misunderstood by the kind of more modern vocabulary that we have. You know, people had were a bit more open minded to vocabulary the further we go back in time, whereas it's all been a bit more standardized now.
They were more, if you look at the older translations, generally speaking, this is not true of everything, obviously, but you'll see sentences translated completely different to the original, because they're not trying to translate the sentence. They're trying to translate the meaning and emotion behind the sentence.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to, there can be sayings or phrases that really translated don't mean anything to the modern reader. So they have to replace it with a modern phrase or modern saying that will invoke the same emotion. So it depends on how you go about that. But I mean, just like I say, going back to what you said, just to jump back a little bit about, when we were talking about the gods and Woden and Wada mean possessed. We have that in a lot of gods. I mean, there's a god called Ogmius, and he's a northern Gaulish god that the Romans, I forget the Roman writer now. It's been a while since I've read it, but he writes about meeting these Gauls and seeing this picture of this god. He doesn't know who he is at the minute, and on this relief, this carving that they've made of this god, they have these silver chains from his tongue attached to the ears of these people following him. And the Roman writer is like, this is like kind of a brutal, horrible scene. What is this? And one of the Gauls could speak Latin. So he says, oh, no, that's Ogmius. His words inspire men. And he explains that although they are chained, they follow freely. But that is a very strong image of how they viewed words, how they viewed the power of speech, that man had such a way, this god had such a way of speaking that men willingly followed his words. They willingly followed him into battle. It's a trait very often found in psychopomps, that they're gods or goddesses that lead men into the afterworld. So Woden is one of those, because obviously with Valhalla, etc., those types of ideas, he takes you into that world.
So it's a way of symbolizing the fact that the words of these gods are so compelling that you have no choice but to follow them, even though you do have a choice. But because they're so compelling, you don't have a choice. And that's represented symbolically by, you know, a link being linked by a chain.
Yeah, in the relief. Yeah. But obviously we see that anyway. It's just words are so powerful. Like I say, you look at the great leaders, even modern era leaders. I mean, you'd be hard stretched in America, for example, to find you know, the average American will probably see JFK as one of their favorite because he was a good orator. He was a good speaker. Yeah. He could stand on stage, he could speak, and he could sell his ideas, right? Because he had it, and that's how he got power. That's how he got, because he invoked the emotion of the people through his words. Now, whether you like him or not is irrelevant. Some people go, well, I don't, he did that. Do you get me? So when somebody can do that, it doesn't matter if you agree with them or not, they did it, right? They spoke their words. And even if you look at some of the modern problems, if you look at the media and modern film, if I mean, as we know, if you look at some modern things being produced now, they're highly sociopolitically charged, right? I mean, that's just the world we live in now. You're hard pressed to find a new program, a new series, or a new movie that hasn't got some sociopolitical message in it somewhere. I mean, and it's always done that to a point, but it's even stronger now because they know that through these dramatizations or these completely fictional works, they can change the sway the opinion of the public. They can move it.
Well, that's
important. We use the same kind of techniques, but in an honest way, in a way that is, our own nature.
That's an important point to raise. Actually, the idea of using emotion, it's a double edged sword. You know, we can use emotion to inspire our kin to better action, to a more positive way of life, but that emotion can also be used against us. And you know, we're not denying that. I mean, that's very much the way that we're being misled in these current times. You know, the reason that so many of our kinsmen, the reason that they have been hoodwinked by the scamdemic is because of the reason that they've ignored the facts and the figures that relating to it is because of the emotion that's been portrayed, you know, been imparted through the mainstream media. So it does work both ways, and that's important to know.
Yeah, we're not in my belief, looking at our history, we're a very emotional people. The Romans, if you look at the Roman works about the Northern Gauls, the Britons, the Germanics, they talk about our wildness, our belief in our absolute belief in our own spiritual beliefs, right? We weren't halfway here or halfway there. We were fully committed. We were at times, to the Roman eyes, who were much more the academic, I suppose, at the time, and much more pragmatic in some ways, we were mad, right? We were completely irrational. And that because we are, in my belief, we are a very emotional people. And I think that comes from some of our genius. If you look at many of the inventions, geniuses, I mean, archetypally, right, are generally seen, or the archetype of them in the modern eye is of someone that's slightly on the edge of madness, right? Somebody that is not just chasing a process, like an academic process. They have some spiritual meaning to almost what they're working on, right? Do you get what I'm saying? With this archetype, this type of crazy genius archetype.
The eccentric genius, yeah.
Yeah, because they're viewing the world in a very different way, in a very unique way. But I think that's part of what we are. We're very emotional. I mean, we're very loving. If you look at Britain, for example, I mean, I was on a bus once just to show the kind of craziness to other countries as well that they don't really see this. And there was a butterfly trapped on this bus. The whole bus was trying to save this butterfly. Complete strangers. And I was living in quite what many people considered a very rough part of town, right? These were very common working class people. They were very, that people often put derogatory names to, which I don't. But and they're all there trying to save this butterfly, right? You know, this kind of, but sadly, it is our greatest strength, because when used properly, you can invoke in our people a sense of who they are, a sense of what they are, and they were conquer the world, and they did. Okay, let's make the British, for example. They did. Now they didn't know exactly what they would do. You know, it wasn't for necessarily, it wasn't for their good. I always say about the Empire, you know, by our blood it was made and by our tears it was suffered. But they did that. But it's about evoking this this powerful sense in them, because we're emotional creatures and we kind of bridge the gap between the academic and the emotional in, I believe, a perfect way, because obviously I'm Northern European and I love my folk. And another way to tell our story, if we just touch back to the emotional side, I love my folk. I love my ancestors, the ascendants, a word that I like to use now with them. But these people, I mean, I can't explain it properly. My works try to explain my love for my folk, and I want to tell their story in a loving way, not just an
academic. This is a conversation I've had, you know, with a few people, probably yourself included, over the last couple of years. And it not only applies to the defiance that, you know, many of us have shown to these ridiculous mandates over the last couple of years, but it also applies to all of the wars which our folk have fought over the years. You know, I know people who would say to me, why make life difficult for yourself? Why are you, you know, defying this mandate or whatever? If you just go along with it, then you get to do this, this, and this. And from a purely pragmatic point of view, you can't argue that. They're absolutely right. And the same applies to war. It, you know, if you were to sit down and say to folks before, you know, either of the world wars, you know, you sit down with a bunch of you know, British men and say, right, okay, this war is coming up. If you surrender, you will be allowed to live. Okay, you might have to change the way that you live your life, you know, and this, you know, by the way, I'm going off the official story here. You know, we won't go into what really happened with the wars, but just going by the official story, you could say to those men, you know, you don't need to die. Your family doesn't need to die. You know, if you just surrender, then everything will be fine. You'll have to make a few compromises here and there, whatever. So from a pragmatic point of view, it makes far more sense from a purely kind of intellectual point of view. It makes far more sense to throw down your weapons, throw down your mask, you know, roll up your sleeve, get that jab in your arm. It makes far more sense to do that. But because, as Phil just described, because we are an emotionally driven people, and that emotion includes principles, it includes these kind of abstract principles which you almost can't quantify, because those things mean so much to us. That's why our folk have always been so ready to fight these wars, where they knew that there was a good chance that they would die, but they were fighting for a higher principle, and that was driven by emotion.
It has to be. I mean, that was the talking point there at the beginning of what you said, is the consequence of cowardice. It's we can continually, like, in the decision for that individual in his time period, it is, like you say, far more pragmatic for him to go along. But each generation gives away something else. I remember speaking to somebody. I was in a debate somewhere. I can't remember where now, but they were. I'd said something about Boudicca and how you know, how brave and noble she was, you know, because you've got to remember people don't really understand that story, because they raped Boudicca's daughters, which were actually the queens of the Ikenai at the time, because they'd been given that title after their father's passing, along with the emperor, who had became a joint king with the daughters as queens. So, but they raped them, right? And people go, well, you know, Boudicca failed. Right, somebody was trying to say Boudicca failed, it was a failure, and loads died. What was the point? So they were taking a very pragmatic stance. And I was like, well, what was their options? Yep, they were a proud people. And, you know, the Christians will have you believe that pride is a sin. Yeah, and that's a great con of them. Because pride is an example of who we are. It's what we believe we are. It's the archetype of the gods. Yeah. It's how we envision ourselves.
Yeah.
Our pride is attached to that. Our principles are attached to that. If we sell that, if we decide that living is more important than who we are, what we represent, yeah? Then what are we, right? I don't know what we are. What are we then?
Yeah,
are
we just... we've lost what makes us great, what makes us wonderful, and what makes us unique, yeah.
The Kimbri, the Ikenai, by their character, had no option but to do what they did. It was a duty to themselves, to their own belief in themselves. They refused slavery, the same as the Kimbri. The Kimbri couldn't turn away at that battle. They even, you know, in the final battle, because we never finished that series, but what we're going to do, just so people we're going to like redo the series and give it an ending in one big video, because like I say, we're going to move forward to the thing. But at the very end, I mean, people can read about it, but the emotional aspect of that, at the very end, they meet, Marius Gaius meets with Boiryx. And the Kimbri say, oh, we're waiting for our brothers, the Teutons. And Gaius makes a snide remark, like, well, they have their land and they'll have it forever because they've been defeated. So they're dead in the battlefield, right?
Mm.
So immediately Boiryx says, okay, then we'll have our fight. You tell us where and when. The Romans, this is just a point of the Romans' pride, right? They were demanded there in a way, because the Romans have to qualify what happens next with, although the Romans do not generally take orders from the Kimbri, they decided it was advantageous to do so in that time. So they saw that as an order, right? The Boiryx had gone, you tell us where and when. We think that is a disadvantage in the modern age, but that was a slight on them that they were given this opportunity, but they took it and they picked favorable conditions. But it was in the, so you, people attack the Kimbri. Sometimes on the videos, you'll see people say, you know, oh, well, they failed, what a bunch of, but they stayed true to themselves. And that's something that I think Mimersbrunn has been about all along, even when I haven't really known it in such. Is that these big events happen, but the most important thing, whether we're going to win, lose, whether a dictatorship is going to, you know, whether this global dictatorship is going to smash us, destroy us, right? It doesn't. At some point, all of that fades, and it is about what we do as an individual, who we are. As I said before, the archetypes of the, you know, we must represent that which we love. So if I've always told people, if they want to know how to, you know, they go, I want to do a blot, or I want to do this. Well, first of all, what God do you think represent, or what God do you believe you represent? Well, who do you align the most with? Well, find that God and be its champion. Be their champion. Whether it be a god or a goddess, be their champion. Be their voice here. Be inspired, you know, and try to live as that. And if we do that, right, take the recent, you know, the COVID situation. If everybody that knew what they were going to do, that didn't want to do it, didn't do it, we'd be in a much stronger position, right? But yeah, like you said, many people went along with it. They abandoned themselves. They sold themselves. They sold a small part of themselves for an easier life. Yeah, and I think that's what the consequence of cowardice, you know, if we define cowardice as doing what you know to be wrong, but doing it for an easier life, doing it to avoid a consequence in the moment, but essentially selling yourself to a consequence later down the line.
Yeah, I mean, at the very beginning of the show, you made a comment, which I was going to pick up on at the time, about how there are a million struggles going on in your back garden,
yeah,
that you don't even know about. And you said, you know, you said, oh, maybe that doesn't, that's not, you know, that's not an example of courage. But actually, in combination with what you've just said, it is, because doing what you are supposed to do naturally is essentially bravery, and not doing what you're supposed to do naturally is cowardice. So, you know, a dragonfly flitting around in your back garden, it doesn't make these kind of moral judgments about what it's going to do next, how it's going to react to a situation. It just follows its natural instinct. We as humans kind of uniquely have this ability to, not uniquely, but we're more likely than most other animals to shy away from our destiny, from our what's expected of us as a human being, particularly in modern times. And when we do that, that is an example of cowardice.
Yeah, I mean, all creatures act accordingly to what they are. You know, the deer will run, the wolf will chase, right? And they embody what they are. They make no excuses for it. I mean, part of the but with the modern world, we have a few complexities. We are tribal creatures by nature. We live in small groups that are closely knit, that know, and we know everything about each other. The modern world has allowed, especially with the advent of the internet, has allowed us to hide behind lies about ourselves. You know, we want to project images of ourselves rather than realities of ourselves. And it has become, I mean, we've always done that to a point with our stories, but it's become so easy to do now that we can hide behind our own lives. I mean, this is what we see, you know, with people trying to, I mean, you know, when people are trying to, I forgot the term now, but when they're essentially, all their social media posts are about this or about that. They're just trying to pretend an image. I forgot what it's, there's a
virtue signaling
word, or virtue signaling. Yeah, they're signaling to the world that this is what I am, but they don't really do it. They'll talk about ethics and moralities and these poor people here or these poor people there, but they've got an iPhone made in some sweat factory in China or something. They don't care. They don't really care. Their words are nothing. But that's what happens, I believe, to a people that sell themselves all the time. Because every time you sell a piece of yourself by doing something you know to be incorrect, you do it and you don't learn from it. Because generally, shame. Younger, I had a problem with shame on a personal level, but I learned to adore it in a way. Shame allowed me to see what I was not. Yeah. So if I came away from a situation and I felt very bad and I'm beating myself up, I started to say, when I felt like that, rather than see that as a bad thing, like, oh, I've messed up and try to, self-flagellate, and just beat myself, I started to go, hold on, I'm being taught there's a part of me that is so opposed to what I did that I need to change. And if I ever feel that feeling, I correct my behavior. I realize that's not who I am.
Yeah,
I'll find out who I am. Yeah, and I can represent what I am. But I think, like I say, just to go back to what I was saying about the virtue signal, I think when people sell ourselves, we become empty. How many times have you heard people talk about this hole in themselves? They feel an emptiness.
Yeah,
they have no purpose. They have no meaning in their life. They go because they're selling themselves every day, a bit of themselves, and it's taking a hole out of them. And then they're trying to fill it with with what's being given to them, right? This fake nourishment from the media, this fake emotion from the news, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, COVID is a great example of this, not to go into it too deep, but in the UK, we have this clapping for the NHS, right? This fake, so they stole their community by locking them all indoors. They stole it, and then they give them this fake sense. Go outside and clap. There you go. You're part of something. Right, so they took the real and they give you something, and then that person feels a little emptier, but they don't know why. And I'm not blaming people for this. We all want to be part of something. It's very important to us. Like I say, we're tribal by nature. But
this goes back to people might be interested to go back to episode number 3 of the podcast where with my friend Hadrian we discussed Ted Kaczynski's concept of surrogate activities. And this is what we're being sold in the modern times, you know, because our ability to perform meaningful actions in our lives has been taken away because it you know, all of us living in a natural way, performing meaningful actions, going through the power process, as Ted Kaczynski would have said, that poses a problem for the control system, the tyrannical system that wants to control us. So instead, what they do is they give us these, they promote these surrogate activities, such as Phil's example of clapping for the NHS. You know, it's this way of feeling virtuous without actually being virtuous.
Yeah, and feeling like you're in a community when they've actually stole that very community. Yeah, because you can't actually go, you can't actually go and speak to your neighbor, right? You can't go around to their house. That was banned, right?
You're literally forbidden from doing that. Yeah.
Forbidden from doing that. But you can feel part of something and you're doing, with the virtue signal, you're doing something good, but you're not really doing anything. But it's, again, it's feeding this. And like I say, the more we self, every time we act, every action we do that we feel a bit ashamed of, that we have to, and you know this, we've all done it, where we try to justify it, right? You'll speak to people, and they're justified with pragmatism, or they're justified in other ways. When they do that, you don't have to argue with that person. They've sold, they know they're in the wrong.
They know they know they've given a piece of themselves away.
And they'll get a hole and they'll have lack of purpose and meaning. I mean, the best thing and a really good thing for you too, and what I've been thinking about, what I wanted to talk about tonight really was, you know, because I was getting down with it, or it can get down and several times throughout my many, many years looking into certain things and being part of certain communities, I've got dejected, right? And I think that's a common feeling. You can get all hyped up, something's going to change, then actually it just gets worse. And the leaders you thought were going to take you somewhere, they turn out to be not what you expected. And we've all been duped. We've all been fooled. And we can get very down. So that's where, I mean, especially in the Northern European tradition of the heroic quest, the personal journeys, you can find a lot of meaning, because try and do everything with purpose and meaning. If you're going to do a blot, do it with absolute conviction. Right. If you're going to do anything, do it with conviction, and just don't bend. Right. And people go, well, that's easier said than done. And I've got this to look after, and I've got this to look after. But like I say, but how much of yourself have you got to give away? I think focusing on ourselves, we get this life, and let's be honest, even the most spiritual among us, I can't say exactly what happens when we pass. I can't say exactly where we came from. I can just see the traditions of my people, know my soul, what I am, to know how to act. And I know that I feel bad, you know, if I do things if I feel like I'm a coward. When I was younger, I used to hate it. The feeling of being cowardly would really wrench at me. To the point where when I was younger, I remember, say I was walking late at night and I was like a 14-year-old or something. There was a group of like 18, 20-year-olds over the road. And I was like, oh, no, this could get – I deliberately crossed to walk through them to like try and conquer that fear, if you know what I mean. Just I've got to walk right through the middle of them. I've got to – because this would do worse than kill me. This fear will control me, you know.
This is the power. This is the power, I think, of particularly ancestral religions or ancestral traditions like paganism, because you know, as you mentioned earlier, our idols, our figureheads, our heroes, the gods, they act that their bravery, their greatness, their prowess in battle, their physical strength. These are the aspects of them which are boasted of, which are spoken up. So our pagan ancestors always had this vision in their minds of what to aspire to, and it was always something impressive. It was just instilled from a very early age, particularly among the men of our folk, that you were supposed to imitate the gods in their glory. You weren't supposed to make a virtue of meekness or suffering. You were supposed to be powerful and great and brave and strong. And when you made an oath, when you made a boast, you followed through with it, because to not follow through with an oath or a boast was one of the most shameful things that a man could do. Contrast that with the modern times where, you know, as Phil has just been saying, on social media, people make a million promises a day, which they don't live up to. And there's no consequence for that. There's no mechanism within our social structure which causes any kind of repercussion or any comeback for making those broken, false, empty promises. Whereas with our ancestral religion, we are expected to hold ourselves to a high standard. We are expected to follow through with what we say we're going to do. And that makes for a far healthier, greater folk.
Yeah. I mean, and I think we suffer as well in many of the individual betterments of, again, the pragmatic. I think we focus heavily. People will debate and argue diet and training regimes and get fit. And they talk about all these things and they forget the emotional and the spiritual aspect.
Yeah.
That's not to say the pragmatic is not important. Pragmatism has an importance, of course. But when you really see people, you've got to change your philosophy, you know, people, because it's kind of unquantifiable. When you get people messaging about Mimsville, they want to know what to do. They don't know what to do. And there's this feeling that they're doing it wrong, right? I'm not sure what to do with the spiritual or the philosophical. They're not sure how to go about those that easy, because obviously with diet, we can look at, again, you'll get people arguing different diets and they're all use their own graphs and their own studies and their own whatever. And we can kind of quantify that. We go, okay, I can look at this and this means if I eat this, I'll be better. But with the spiritual aspect, it's much harder to do, you know, because you've either got to accept this person's opinion or, you know, you'll have people that will want to lead exactly what to do. But I've always took it, although I read massive amounts of things on our ancestors from archaeological reports, like say to ancient works, most of my spiritual practice in personal life comes from how I feel, right? What I want to do, how I feel to do it. Because as I think I've said to you before in our personal conversations, that, you know, if I look at the history, because I don't even class myself as a Norse heathen, or I'm a Northern European heathen, and that follows us back all the way through probably the aspects I'm probably most compelled by, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Bronze Age probably more even so than the Iron Age, but I have more information on the Iron Age. But the exact methods that they used in their spiritual practice change, but the sentiment remains the same.
Yeah.
This sentiment obviously becomes the most important aspect in that.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to the first couple of episodes of the podcast, but this is something that I've been really, really keen to get across. You know, as you said earlier in the conversation, Phil, there are plenty of people in our sphere who are academically excellent. They're incredibly knowledgeable. They've got degrees. They have they've shared stages with other academics. They have written books, and there are people who are already fulfilling that role. I think what people like yourself and I, our strength is that we have this this passion, and we have this experience of practice. And although we may not have practiced in a way which everybody would deem precisely authentic, what the message I'm trying to get across is that that doesn't matter, especially at the beginning. You know, you can, if you want to, you can work towards authenticity, but don't wait to become a perfectly authentic practitioner before even getting started. As long as your intention is in the right place, as long as you are giving it your all, as long as you are performing your rites with emotion, with sincerity, the precise actions that you take, they're not as important as doing it with the right sentiment.
I'd agree entirely. And like many, even if I've read many academic sources, knowing exactly what happened and what occurred in what order is very hard anyway, in the academic. So trying to find out how to do it, I think would be almost, you would never get there to the point you thought you were doing it right, according. And like I say, if I go from Bronze Age Britain to Iron Age Britain, I'll find very different burial practices, very different. But they're in the same vein. They're in the same, like I say, the intention. And that is, for me, if it is done, as you say, with sincerity and devotion, you know, giving yourself, as I said before, giving yourself to it fully, I think it has the same, I don't see a difference, personally, at all.
No.
And you could go from tribe to tribe in the Bronze Age and find different variations on different things and different views even of certain gods and goddesses. And that wasn't seen as bad. It was because they followed their inclination, as I was saying before. We are them, as you mentioned. They are us. We will probably do it right more often than we will do it wrong.
And it's a living tradition as well. So there's nothing to say that we can't develop our own completely new relationship with the gods in these modern times. You know, we may find ourselves performing rites in a way which has never been attested in any of the sources, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong. I'm not saying that we can just, you know, make everything up and start again from scratch. I'm saying that this is a living tradition, and that the gods are, they've come along for the ride with us. You know, they're not stuck at one particular moment in time. And I believe that both they and the folk who they love and who love them, they adapt to the times that we're living through. And what we're going through now, this highly technological time, has different demands to, you know, the more technologically primitive times of, say, the Bronze Age.
Of course. And they adapted. You can watch academics talk about the adaptation of a god throughout time, how a god changes slightly throughout time. I don't believe that they're static either. The folk have grown, so must they. I mean, unless, like you say, that idea comes from what you were saying before about how we phrase it wrong, like we were or they were. It comes from the same idea that this is something that was. Yeah?
Yeah.
It isn't no more. It has to be a living religion to be a religion, but a living religion. And I call it religion. Some people have a part. I don't, you know, it's for me, it's picking it. And for me, my religion leads me into everything else. My belief, my heathenism, gives me my moral compass, or however you want to. I mean, I don't, to be honest, I have a problem with morality as a whole in the whole concept, constraints of it. I think it's heavily Christianized, the whole concept of morality. I think our ancestors dealt very much in an honor system as opposed to morality. Because an honor system is much more individual focused or tribally focused, you know.
Yeah, I did a post. I don't know if you've seen The Northman, Phil, but I haven't seen it. Yeah, I did a post on Telegram explaining this, because I think it was Morgoth was questioning the kind of lack of universal morality there. And it's a fair question, because it's difficult for us to understand with our modern perception how, you know, we've been raised with this idea that there is this universal morality, and that is a very Christian idea. In, as you say, Phil, morality of the past was honor based. It was subjective to the tribe. It wasn't this kind of universal universal objective morality.
People have a problem with like a moral relativist point, right? As an observer of nature and as well as reading the sources, I mean, the best way to get into heathenism is just observe nature. Just observe it in its true form. Don't put any illusion on it. Observe it in its brutal horror sometimes. Observe it. And some of when you find yourself finding yourself at odds with the nature of the world, explore that. That's a really interesting place that you personally should explore, wherever that may be.
Yeah.
But if, you know, and I learn from nature what's good for the, you know, I can watch a documentary on TV. I can see a lion chasing down a gazelle. Well, where is, you know, the universal morality there? I don't see it, you know. I see both animals have a universe. They have their own honor system that they both must live, right? And they both must live, and they do what they are meant to do. The gazelle, right, will run away. The lion will chase. And based on how good they are at being what they are, one will live, one will not. You know. So I'm the universal morality really is a problematic. Like, this is good and this is bad. I don't see that in nature. I see that everything, and if we take people as what's good for, and I say people and I talk individual, but I think one of the big tricks of the modern world is to trick us that we're individuals and freedom is all about our freedom on a personal level. And they juxtapose it against like a world governing body, like this universalist idea of what's best for mankind, when the truth is in the middle. Nationalism or tribalism, the truth is that a people are free, not an individual, or a people are successful because we are tribal. We're not individuals, but we're also not, you know, this is why I consider myself a nationalist, because if I look at us as a creature of nature, we are tribal. And if we take the Iron Age, for example, you didn't have to buy a plot of land to build your roundhouse in Iron Age Britain, right? You were allotted land for being part of the tribe. And if your tribe needed more land, your tribe went out as one and got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't about, and if you got a bigger hut or whatever, it's because you had proved yourself as worthy, right? You were heroic in battle. You had done something that goes, okay, you have more status than I. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really good way to illustrate it. You weren't granted a plot of land to build your hut on by this kind of this distant universal governing force, because it was your right to do that. You didn't have the individual freedom as determined by this universal law. The reason that you had the ability to take a piece of land and build a hut on it is because your tribe dominated that area. So it's because the freedom that your tribe had carved out for itself became your individual freedom. It wasn't something higher that granted you that plot of land.
No, it was your blood had given it, been granted, and that's how nature works.
Yeah,
you can look at wolf territories. I mean, I enjoy watching nature documentaries just to observe nature of things that I can't readily observe myself, you know. I can go to the woods and observe everything that I can, but obviously for some of the different, you know, wolves and that, because especially Britain, we don't have many of these bigger predator type animals. But if you look at those, they earn everything by right. They're right, and this is why, you know, might is right is a brilliant phrase. I think the phrase is brilliant. I'm not a fan of the book. I read it and I didn't really like the book. I thought it went into some very obscure places, but the phrase is brilliant, right? Because it's a very simplifies it. Might is right. Because I would just add a note there that based on what we're talking about, especially like might is right, but the wolf must always act like the wolf. So if I am an Anglo-Saxon, I must act as an Anglo-Saxon. So it doesn't mean I can just go and do what I want. It means I must stay true to what I am. And if I do that, that's when there is a harmony, right? All people should act true to themselves. And this is why I try not to get into this idea of necessarily good, bad. Like, if there are people that decided that they want to rule over everybody else, and that's what they believe they are, and don't think that... you know, either look at secret societies or whatever you want to look, they become a tribal institution, right? They become a group where they swear oath to each other and allegiance to each other, that if you are in trouble, I will help you no matter what. I will put everything I have on the line for you. And if we all do that for each other, when any one of us falls, everybody's hands reach down to pick them up. They become a tribe. And these tribes, whether natural tribes in nature or tribes established through a process of a society or a group, they become tribal and they have their own tribal game and they have their own historic. You could take any secret society and see that they have a history now. They have a genealogy almost, you know. They really embodied the tribe in the mastery, and that's why they have so much power.
In effect, those secret societies or other tribal ethnic groups, they are actually living more closely to the natural order than we in the West are today. The only problem is that they've successfully convinced most of us, particularly in the West, that this system of tribalism is no longer relevant. You know, so we're all sitting here. Well, you know, I say we as in kind of the royal.
Yeah,
we, all of us. You know, we're sitting here thinking, you know, why aren't they playing fair? Why aren't they playing by the rules that we think that society is meant to be governed by? Well, it's because those rules were never meant to apply to them. They set that system, this kind of system of civility up for us so that we would be more easily subsumed by their tribal actions.
Yeah, I mean, I remember dabbling in anarchy when I was younger and came to my awareness that actually that all the rules, that actually I believe that the people, the most powerful people in the world understood that anarchy was a constant, right? Yeah. And that they gave us rules. We accepted those and expect them to play fairly.
Yeah.
They probably just laughed at us. And at the top, we can see this out of all history, right? We can see it from kings or whatever. They're killing each other, going to war, rejecting each other, having these massive battles and deceptions amongst themselves, whilst we're all playing by these very strict set of rules. And we can't do that. Oh, we're not allowed to, you know. I mean, I had this very realization when I was a child, right? I was in primary school and I'd got in a fight, right? And we'd fought each other, and I got in a lot of trouble with this. And I was very young, I was probably about 8 or 9. And I remember going, but he did this to me, and I defended myself, and I don't see a problem with that. And this teacher was trying to tell me how bad it was, but then I was like, we'd done a history lesson on World War II, and I was like, well, in World War II, you told me in the lesson that they attacked us and we had to defend ourselves. And I was like, I don't understand this position. I couldn't, as this child me was confused, right? Okay, so it was okay there, but it's not okay here. And I felt very, I had a bit of a problem at the time because I didn't realize at the time, obviously, I'd obviously come across a problem that I couldn't solve at the time. But later I realized that this was the, you know, we have a one set of rules for us where they have none because, they've just convinced us, like you say, especially about the tribalism, that it's bad. I mean, we can see that, I love my people and they want to give, because I'm an ethnic nationalist, I'm a folkish heathen, and I have no problem about that. But people go, oh, I'm not hateful at all. I love my people. And I believe all people should love my people. If I ask a Turk who are the greatest people in the world, if he doesn't ask a Turk, I'll think less of him. If I ask a Chinese person who the greatest people in the world are, and he doesn't say Chinese, I think less of him. Yeah. Love for your own and what you are brings pride and purpose. I did a live stream once on Mimersbunner where I talked. I'd seen this. I think you watched it. I saw these kids in a UK school where they're being taught basically that they're evil, and there was a scene where they asked, they separated out the English children, although there's meant to be no distinction, the English children from these people with an ethnic background, and they asked them what it meant to be who they were, right? So what does it mean to be English? Honestly, the English children sat there silently. The ethnic minority children, they were dancing and explaining their culture, and they were so happy. And this woman, who happened to be of an ethnic origin herself, who was meant to be like the psycho analyzing this, she actually says it looks like a funeral in the English.
I remember that program, and I remember your stream about it. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, and that is, these children were scared to, and that made me sad. That made me tear up. Frustrated, because I saw small English children, beautiful. Being broken by the system, feeling that they were worthless. You want to know the problems of depression, suicide, all these drug abuse? It comes from that feeling that you have no purpose and that you are worthless and that you are bad.
Yeah.
And it's making me emotional thinking about it now, because there is nothing more beautiful than our children. I mean, the innocence.
Yeah, and it's only got worse generation to generation. I mean, you know, you and I had it to an extent. I mean, we're roughly the same age, roughly the same generation. We had it to an extent as we were growing up, but this idea that, you know, English and European children are at best lacking any kind of unique culture, and at worst are responsible for all of the world's ills. They have this kind of racial original sin. This idea has only become more prevalent over the last 20, 30 years, to the extent now where mainstream British television can air programs essentially shaming young English children for merely being born English. And that was what that program amounted to. Because even though I remember it, even though it didn't point the finger at them and say you are evil, the whole setup of the program was designed to elicit that kind of self-realization in the children, this realization that they have been born into this kind of it's like an idea of original sin, and it has gotten worse now. I think it was Tim Wise, I think he is, did some kind of short YouTube video. I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe even less actually. I can't remember how long ago it was, but he did basically the same thing with American children, but it was even more overt. He was basically saying to the white children, do you realize that you have white privilege? Do you understand that you are responsible for this, that, and the other? So it is only getting worse, and this is why there is no universal morality anymore, because it's not being applied universally. There is no sense of fairness, and our only response as people who happen to be of English or Northern European or wider European extraction, our only response to that can be that we have to turn our sense of morality into a more tribal, subjective one.
Like I say, but it's all about who we are and loving. Like I said, there's nothing more precious and more beautiful than a child. I mean, you look at a toddler. Have you ever met a toddler that you didn't like? Right? They have this energy, this beautifulness about them. That they are targeting these, and I got emotional just, and I probably sound like a right wuss or whatever. I don't really care, to be honest, but a part of me doesn't, so I wouldn't mention it, I suppose. But it does sadden me, right? I mean, to the point of, if I want to see despair, that's where I see it, if you get me. That's when I feel very, when you target these people, just these children, and say those things, it's when, you know, that's like where you want to get off, or, you know, when people say, I want to get off the world or off the planet, because, as I say, purpose, and as I mentioned in that thing, the purpose, the sense of purpose is so important to mental well-being. A sense of pride in the self and who they are and where they come from is so important to mental well-being. And when you remove that aspect, When you tell them that they shouldn't be proud, and I mean you set in motion a life of lack of self-worth. And like I said before, drug abuse, you set into motion a whole host of events that bring that beautiful bloom of life, right? And
it becomes intergenerational. It becomes intergenerational, and that's the important
thing. They pass on their problems to the next, right? So they could alcohol or drug abuse or whatever. They have this void, right? This self hate, this self flagellation, right? So they beat themselves up, and then the next generation become worse for that because they see their parents or should be parents not functioning. And we get poverty and all sorts of problems. And this is known, right? These are things that our society understands. We've understood these things. You can read you can read all about. We know about this. So when we're doing this openly in our society to a group of people that we have deemed need to be taught a lesson because of history, right? That need to be pushed down so others can rise up. When we are doing that, that is a deliberate action.
Yeah,
in my opinion,
and that
can't be conveyed anywhere else. And that's what the importance of the spiritual and the emotional is. Mimas Brunner gets a lot of messages from people, and they're beautiful messages that make me feel even embarrassed about almost in some ways. Because they're too praising, most people, we struggle with too much praise. But how people how the videos have helped them, right? And that those comments, as much as they seem, they make me feel guilty about not making a video. When I read a comment like that, I'm like, I have to put my focus into this, because if it is helping people, these kids that maybe have gone through that system and they find a video that makes them feel like they're worth something, then it's worth something for me. And I think if we all do what we feel we need to do, I believe that we can overcome anything. And even if we don't, even if we can't overcome, we go out as we came in. We keep ourselves. And I think that is that's just as important.
Yeah. And this comes right back round to the whole intention behind Mimas Brunner, as I understand it, which is to teach people of the current generations, of the current times, that they do belong to a great people. It's to put back in some of that pride, which has been, cruelly extracted by our enemies. To be frank about it, and through their means of mainstream media and their other tactics, they have attempted to completely destroy any sense of pride that the modern English person, the modern European, the modern white person, or even people of other nations, I'm sure, who have been under the cosh of kind of other dominant cultures over. Throughout history, it's a common tactic to instill a sense of shame in people. Ooh. And our role, our job needs to be to restore that sense of pride.
All nations are under attack from globalism. I mean, all national interest, all national culture is under attack from globalism, because what's happening in the West right now will happen everywhere. They're not going to let, they want, no diversity, essentially.
None.
They want all the world to be the same. McDonald's on every corner, and Amazon. That is the ultimate goal, because that's easier to control, right? It's, in my belief, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, it could be 100, I don't know how many years away it is, but that's what I believe they are working to, and I can't see a reason why they would be doing what they're doing if they weren't working towards that. Their exact reasoning why they want that, I can't say.
Yeah,
but it definitely seems to me that they're heading that way.
Yeah, I think we'll wind it up there. But I think, as you can hear, Phil is someone who, of all the people I've known, I think Phil is probably the person who has the strongest unconditional love for his folk. And I think that's come across in our conversation tonight. Yeah, thanks a lot, mate, for joining me for the conversation. It's been great as always. And is there anything else you wanted to add before we close up?
No. Thanks for the chat, and it's good to see you getting your voice out there. Because I'd like to say about Dan or Steed, however you want to know him, that he's a friend that I value very highly. And I think he's perfect for what you're doing now with a podcast, because you're one of a very reasoned person that really, when people that don't know you, haven't spoken to you in real life, when you talk to him, you can see he's listening. You can see he's considering what is being said. And I think that is very important in the role that you're doing at the moment. Because so many people, they want to say what they want to say, and they don't really care about what others. Whereas you really do listen to what is being said, and really do take it on board, and then and it makes your responses better. If you get what I'm saying, I'm going on a bit, but I'm really happy that you're doing this. And
thanks, mate.
I think you're a great person for it.
Yeah, cheers, mate. No, I appreciate it. It's still quite early days for the Fergan podcast, and as I say, this is episode number 7, but I've been incredibly heartened with how well it's been received, the amount of support that it's gotten so far, and the private messages that I've had to say that people have got lots of value from it. And it does feel like it's something that I should have been doing, or certainly should have come to at some point. So I'm glad that I made the decision to do it. And hopefully, if you're up for it, hopefully we can have some more chats in the future and find some other great topics of discussion to chew over.
If people are interested, I'll be here for sure.
I'm sure they will be, mate. All right, have a good night, Phil, and I'll speak to you soon. Yeah,
and you, mate.
I hope you all enjoyed that discussion with the ever inspiring Phil at Mimir's Brunner. To end this episode, we'll go through last week's riddle. For those who don't know, each episode I'm reading a riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book, a collection of Old English riddles. So the answer to last week's riddle was the sun. That one wasn't quite so obvious to me. I guess, it had some kind of Christian imagery, beginning with the line, Christ, who alone ordains victories. But I guess lines like, I often scorch mortals, I approach the earth and without a touch afflict a huge host of people. Interesting that in the minds of the person who wrote this riddle, the sun approaches the earth. You know, I know from our perspective it does seem like the sun approaches the earth, but I wonder whether they actually thought that, or whether they did indeed have a heliocentric view of the solar system. So this week's riddle for episode number 7 is as follows. Silent is my dress when I step across the earth, reside in my house or ruffle the waters. Sometimes my adornments and this high windy air lift me over the livings of men. The power of the clouds carries me far over all people. My white pinions resound very loudly, ring with a melody, sing out clearly. When I sleep not on the soil or settle on grey waters, a travelling spirit. So give that one some thought. Maybe you can wind back and re-listen to that if you want to hear it again. And let me know in the comments in the Telegram channel, or by message or whatever, what you think it might be. And next week, in the next episode, I shall read out the answer to that riddle. So for now, thank you for listening and be well.